Hello, this is By Design on RN. Fenella Kernebone with you. Coming up today, a pretty broad design focus, from Y Fronts to the design and expansion of the Art Gallery of New South Wales. Well, coming up in a moment, I visit the director of the Art Gallery of New South Wales to talk about his vision for Sydney Modern, which is the proposed expansion of the gallery spaces. A major competition is underway as they start the process of selecting the architects. We talk about accessible design. Colin Bissett examines the design of the Y Front. And we head off to a concrete shed in northern New South Wales, designed to last for a very long time.
Talked a lot about buildings that last for 300 years and that are still used and resonate with people after a long time. Sometimes they're doing something different than when they started. You know, it's not much different than a shed, really, inside. It's a huge open concrete space where we put our tractors.
Deirdre Plummer there on site at her concrete shed in northern New South Wales. Why was it built to last so long? 300 years. More a bit later on By Design. But today we begin in Sydney at one of the country's major cultural institutions. It's a place that you go to experience art, that's certain, but it's also somewhere to go to. And yes, I'm talking about the Art Gallery of New South Wales on the Woolloomooloo side of Sydney Harbour, across the road from the Botanical Gardens and Sydney's Domain, and with the Opera House close by. Last year, the gallery announced major expansion plans, calling it Sydney Modern, with the aim for the gallery to become, as its director Michael Brand says, a 21st century art museum. And the jury is just now considering which 12 architecture firms will be invited to submit their concept designs, so the process is underway. To hear more about his vision and to check out the view from his office, which overlooks the land that they aim to build on, I caught up with Michael Brand about Sydney Modern and to find out what is not working with the gallery as it is now.
There's nothing really wrong with the gallery as it stands now. It's much loved for very, very good reasons. It's been around Sydney for, you know, technically about 140 years. Our trouble is that our building is too small. It's probably the most popular building of any art museum in Australia. I think that's probably fair to say. But it just is way, way too small. We can't show all the best parts of our collection. So what we're doing is really augmenting and adding on to and improving what's already a wonderful institution.
Okay, so the idea is that you simply need more space. That's as simple as it is?
Not quite as simple as that. We absolutely need more space, but it's not just a matter of building on two or three more galleries to get more space and forget about it. It really is literally thinking about what should an art museum be in the 21st century. This museum is probably really now a 1960s museum if you think about it. The facade is late 19th century. We've got the old court galleries with our early European and colonial Australian art. Fantastic combination of 19th century art, 19th century architecture. Beyond that, the first big expansion opened in 1972, so designed in the late 60s. But we've sort of stayed in that sort of shape of building. You have a front door, fantastic, walk in, you're inside an art museum. We think in the 21st century we want it to be more indoor-outdoor. We want different sorts of spaces. So to go beyond the pure entrance, temporary exhibition spaces for exhibitions, so-called permanent galleries for collection, a couple of education spaces, cafe, shop, finished. Different art forms in the 21st century, perhaps more film, more performance, different sort of learning spaces. We don't want to stick kids in a classroom. They've got that at school. But we can't serve all the school groups who like to come here for visits.
So it's kind of twofold. The idea is that through the new architecture, the new design, that you will bring in a bigger audience, a different audience, an expanded audience. But it also has to complement the programming too.
Yeah, because you're inviting the audience to come to see the collection and to see our programs. You're not just inviting them to the front door for the sake of increasing numbers. It's also a matter of knowing when they come. No, now we're sort of a 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. sort of museum. I think in the
21st... That has to change, surely.
Well, it has to change. Yeah. It makes no sense. So we've got to think, you know, when can people come? How do they come? So we need to think not just about the new spaces, but what about public transportation? So we're talking about a new ferry stop we'd share with the Botanic Gardens down in Woolloomooloo. It seems that the train station option is not going to be possible, but you've got to think about the barriers as well as the attractions.
Let's just talk about this idea of Sydney Modern opening up itself to the landscape, to Sydney, to the Opera House, to the harbour that we see out here as well. It's not just, as you say, about the gallery and having more space. You've just been talking about transport and linkages, which is extremely important, this kind of precinct area that needs to kind of slowly be created. So how do you work with those different stakeholders to make that happen?
Well, we're working very closely with the Royal Botanic Gardens and Domain Trust because they basically own the land around the museum. We're quite unusual in the fact that we really only sort of own our footprint, a tiny bit of space outside the cafe, but otherwise it's mainly owned by the RBG. What we've discovered, though, which is a little bit more complicated, is that where we're going to move, hopefully, down towards the harbour, there are basically two concrete slabs. There's a concrete slab over the Carl Expressway with about a metre of soil and grass on the top. That, we discovered, actually doesn't belong to the Botanic Gardens. That belongs to the Roads and Maritime Services. Then you go over the land bridge, you go down towards Woolloomooloo, and there's another concrete slab over disused Navy oil reservoirs from the Second World War. Again, concrete slab, you know, some grass on top. That does belong to the RBG. So we're working most closely with them. But then Ausgrid gets involved because there's a power substation just beyond the oil tanks. And that will be decommissioned sometime, we think, about 2020. So there's a question of what will happen to that building. We don't need that space, but if we expand in that direction, the RBG goes through their planning, and then we have a ferry stop down there. To have a really ugly, dirty concrete bunker down there doesn't make any sense.
On Barazan, I'm talking to the director of the Art Gallery of New South Wales. His name is Michael Brand, and we're sort of sitting in his office at the moment overlooking the harbour and the Woolloomooloo Wharf. And the idea, of course, is that Sydney Modern will expand the current art gallery as it stands now. It's almost like this idea that there's a trio in your vision, that we have the Opera House, the Harbour Bridge, as we enter into this part of the city of Sydney, and then there's this new space that is the Art Gallery of New South Wales. What's your imaginings of what that will look like? What are you hoping for?
Well, in terms of that trio you talk about, I think the most exciting trio is actually Opera House, Botanic Gardens, Gallery, because we're contiguous. I mean, where else in the world could you experience a walk like that and alongside the harbour as well? I think the thing with the building is we genuinely don't have a feeling for what it might look like, because it's a complex site with many levels, you know, from Woolloomooloo right up to the gallery. The current building, we just don't know. What we have to make sure we do is we find a number of architectural practices from both Australia and anywhere else who can work with us to give some sort of form to that vision. So part of the vision is a logistical, practical vision, and part of it is an inspirational vision. Part of it's, you know, how the building links in with the city. I really don't have a clue what it's going to look like. But what we don't want is an architect who just says, this is what I build, you can have one of these, and it's almost like it's just, you know, dropped in from the air on our site, and that's done.
Plonk architecture.
Plonk architecture, exactly. That's what we have to avoid at all costs. It has to be a collaborative project between the architects and our team and others.
We do have the Opera House, for example, which was incredibly risky at the time, and the decision even to have that chosen by a jury, that in itself is a story that's very famous, Saarinen and, you know, coming in saying, I want that one that was already on the reject pile. What should this one be? Should it be a risk-taking thing? Should it be a spectacle?
I think we don't want it to... We're not aiming for it to be a spectacle. It could end up being spectacular. That would be no problems. But that is not our first goal. If that is your first goal, I believe you end up with a museum which can be totally dysfunctional and have a very, very short span of being considered interesting or cool. And I don't want to name names because it's a bit embarrassing for my colleagues, but I think we all know the sort of museums around the world which hit that mark.
You mean like Bilbao in Spain?
Well, I think Bilbao actually I think does work, but there are others, you know, which are more complicated. You know, the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto is an example where it's very dramatic, very spectacular, but not terribly functional, and didn't actually solve all of their problems. So we're not setting out just to find a spectacle to balance with the Opera House. But whoever is designing it is clearly going to be thinking that, you know, the Opera House is just across the garden. And that's going to be a very interesting response. I think in the back of all of our minds is, are we having a competition which would allow for something like the Opera House to emerge? And so we've been very clear as we look for our first 12 architects to invite to stage one. Do we have a range of types of practice? Do we have a range of where the practices sit in Australia and around the world? And also, do we have a range of scale of practice? Because it could be that the best solution comes from quite a small firm, where just someone has that great idea of here's the old building, here's the harbour, here's the gardens, here's the site, and they just get it.
So this first stage, of course, is you've selected the jury, which includes Hedy Perkins and Glenn Murcutt, of course, and a number of other significant architects and yourself. They choose the 12 firms, and then that gets whittled down. That's where you're at the moment.
Correct. So what we're doing, we're in the process now of getting 12 firms registered for the stage one of it. So they'll be sent in the next few days the stage one brief, and then they will have a couple of months to come back to us before Christmas with some quite broad concepts of how they'd approach the site, our current building, how they'd mesh them together, how they'd work with us as a collaborative process. Those 12 submissions will be judged anonymously. So the jury, the seven of us on the jury, know who the 12 architects are, but we won't know which submission belongs to which architect.
Okay. What do you really want? Like, what do you, Michael Brand, the guy who goes to the gallery, actually want to see?
I want to see a building where the experience of art is really an exhilarating one. For me, the key relationship is between an art museum and its city. There is no one model for an art museum where you just say, okay, you know, the Met got it right in New York, we're going to build the Met. It's about collecting history, it's about architectural history, it's about the climate, the landscape. So we have to find the perfect Sydney art museum. And to make it, when you come to look at art here, you are looking at art in Sydney, it's relevant to Sydney, but it's also relevant globally. And that's the interesting challenge, how both as a museum director can you get the art working that way, but how also can the architecture work that way, be local, but also be global.
And on By Design, Michael Brand there, the director of the Art Gallery of New South Wales, talking about his vision for Sydney Modern. And yes, as mentioned, the jury is in the process of selecting the 12 architects. The announcement is taking place in the next week or so, so we will keep you posted here on By Design as the details come up. But for the moment, do head to our website for more info. Coming up next, when did the Y front usurp the long john in men's undergarments? And we visit a concrete shed in northern New South Wales designed to last for a very long time.
You're listening to By Design here on RN with Fenella Kernebone.
Indeed you are. It is fantastic to have your company. Michael McKenzie will be joining you next with RN First Bite. Michael, hello.
Hi there, Fenella. Yes, today we're talking as part of our Mental As conversation all this week about the relationship between food and mood. Mm. 5 years ago, the relationship between mental health and what we eat would have been laughed out of the laboratory, but not anymore. People are taking this very seriously.
Okay, so that's the first bit. And the second half of the show?
We're off to a remote part of Cuba, where there's a very special sweet that's highly prized across the island. At the same time, they're in their 54th year of a US trade embargo, which means looking for certain kinds of food can be a really hard ask.
Okay, RN First Bite with Michael coming up next. Thanks, Michael.
Cheers.
There's a land beyond the front door, near where the bike leans, and nobody sees. It's like a good dream. In the dark you hold me, and we go slow dancing, like we're in a movie. And nobody knows, and nobody sees, the land near where the bike leans. Oh darling, I've got yours, and darling, you've got mine.
This is By Design and a taste there of a fantastic singer-songwriter. Her name is Lisa Mitchell, and The Land Beyond the Front Door. Things that we like to discuss here on By Design. And of course, as always, you can find more information about our music throughout the week on By Design's Facebook page. Now, the why. Why was the Y front designed like a Y? Big questions. And who was the designer of this form of underclothes for men? Here is Colin Bissett with an accessible design story.
In the days when what a man wore under his trousers was of no interest to anyone but the laundry or his lover, the long john kept the legs warm. But with the popularity of swimming briefs in the 1930s, as the Western world fell in love with the notion of physical exercise, a man called Arnold Kneibler, who worked for a clothing company in Wisconsin called Cooper's, came up with a variant that was to be worn under clothes. Launched in 1935, it was based on the sportsman's jockstrap, which gave support where it was needed and freedom to move. Cooper's called them the jockey brief, although the term Y-front was universally adopted thanks to the crucial Y-shaped design, which gave support while allowing access whenever nature called. The slang name jocks is still used. 10 years earlier, the manufacturer of shorts for boxers had introduced a version as underwear. The battle of boxer versus Y-front has raged ever since, with the fertility implications of support versus freedom being the touted issue. In the late 1960s, the Y-front became impossibly old-fashioned, thanks to the height of its waistline. Racier, low-cut briefs were more in tune with the air of sexual permissiveness. But the Y-front's day wasn't over. In 1982, when Calvin Klein plastered pole vaulter Tom Hindhouse on billboards, wearing nothing but his tighter, whiter version of classic Y-fronts, the tide turned. The appreciative eyes of wives and gay men took particular notice, quickly making Y-fronts the preferred accessory for the gym-honed body. As a symbol for the fickle nature of fashion, you could say it's the full package.
Colin Bissett there. I just learnt something talking about the Y-front in our design files on By Design. And now we head in the field and we're off to an old dairy farm, which is now being restored back to a native rainforest. Just outside of Federal, near Byron Bay in northern New South Wales, the forest is being planted with native trees, many of which will take up to 300 years to mature. Yes, it's a long-term vision, this one. And as part of this vision, the owners Andy and Deirdre Plummer have built two concrete agricultural sheds, which they've designed to last for at least 300 years and eventually become ruins in the native rainforests. The forest will be completely sustainable way beyond many generations of the Plummer family. Jan Ryan is on site at the farm. It's Kordaloon Desung with Deirdre Plummer and architect John Choi.
Talked a lot about buildings that last for 300 years and that are still used and resonate with people after a long time. Sometimes they're doing something different than when they started. You know, it's not much different than a shed, really, inside. It's a huge open concrete space where we put our tractors.
It is so unique to start something that goes beyond one's lifetime. It is very unique.
We have a limited time with this building. The building has a much longer time with the forest, and that wouldn't have occurred to us when we first bought the farm. It has been a process on both of our parts, I think.
Definitely. When I started the journey, I didn't really know what I was getting myself into until coming up here.
You've got yourself into two incredibly significant concrete buildings, which are agricultural sheds. Now, that in itself is unusual. People usually build sheds, as we know them, out of tin or a lean-to almost, you know, hope for the best, hold it together. This is a statement. This is concrete like you'd probably only see on a major building.
Yeah, it is. But I think that permanence and all the work we've done here is really to give presence to that larger project. So as we see now, if you sort of turn around and look in front where... Across the valley at where the plantation and where the forest will emerge, these trees will grow 30 metres, which effectively will be triple or four times the height you're seeing here. So you'll have this incredible vista that these buildings relate to. And in fullness of time, these buildings will be very settled into the landscape and actually will be something of a surprise when you find them. Here.
But in time, no one will see this building. You'll sort of happen upon it.
That's exactly right.
We actually discussed happening upon ruins in the landscape and talked a bit about ancient ruins and coming in and finding these monumental things. So that sense of discovery and having it embedded into the landscape in a... not secretive, but
Private?
Private, yeah. It was part of the brief, I think.
It was. It was very much part of the brief.
It's very unusual to imagine that the time that you, Deirdre, and Andy and your family have here, and you, John, as the architect, it's hard to imagine that, in fact, the working time, none of us will be here, and our children won't be here, and our grandchildren won't
be here. We've thought about that. Yes, it is. It's quite shocking, but that's the nature of a forest.
And it's the nature of a vision, because you don't have control of it beyond your own time.
No, we don't. Hopefully, everybody will keep these trees growing.
Hopefully,
yes. I think the value of the forest and a sustainably harvestable crop, this is a crop, and it will only be valuable if it's continuously sustained.
Yes.
It's designed so that it will constantly regenerate for 600 years, you know, as long as ever.
Now, we are in one of the sheds, and there's two sheds. So just explain to me how the sheds connect with each other, John.
So the two sheds were sort of conceived together. This one is the main shed. It's habitable. So there's a workshop behind us.
There's a hoist here so you can take the engines out and repair them. There's a wash bay for the trucks down at the bottom of the driveway so you can clean them up. And wash bays for workers with their boots. There's a bathroom and a great kitchen for them to have their smokos.
Everything's so clean-lined and beautiful. The back wall opens up.
Yeah, the whole wall opens up, and they store tools. So it's an office for figuring out how to maintain the trees. There's a big program of still planting going on and then maintaining the trees.
We've had exceptional builders on the craftsmen on the project.
Yeah.
So Lyle, Carl, and stonemasons, etc. You know, if you look at the quality of the concrete here, it's phenomenal. And even when we were drawing things, initially we didn't anticipate that we could try things like this out. But when we realised the level of accuracy they could get in working with concrete, suddenly sort of conversation started about, oh, maybe we can do these things. And
in the bathroom.
Yeah, in the bathroom. Let me have a go.
You've
got to come and have a look at this.
Kitchen sink.
Stainless steel fins that are part of the dish drain that are integrating into the actual pour of the concrete basin. Really, we wouldn't even dream up that that's possible and to get kind of a finished result of this quality. So a lot of these things have happened because of a dialogue between ourselves, between Andy and Deirdre and us and the builder, and together getting to know what they're capable of.
This is a shed among sheds. It really is.
Who's living in a house when you've got a shed like this? So we're now walking up to the second shed, agricultural shed. It's all part of the one project. So what is the second shed that the first shed isn't?
Well, the second shed is primarily a storage shed. So really all it needed is one large open space that could be secured to store various things that are more messy and need quick access to, whereas the first shed is obviously needs office space, workshop, things that you can meet and occupy.
So I can see everything that you want out of the way here.
So just half of this stuff actually should be in shed one.
All of this stuff is in the other shed.
Let's get the key down from its secret hidey hole.
It's really sort of reducing it back to its basic elements, which is that security and set of doors and cover. But over and above that, it's connection to the landscape and the relationship to the first shed.
I remember Andy saying that shed one was too pretty for piles of wire and fence posts and bags of fertilizer and all that stuff. So he said, we need to build a shed where you can put junky stuff. And that's what we've got.
Yeah. This shed, you can really just throw the stuff in and you can throw whatever. You don't have to worry about how it's, you know, necessarily organized or looks.
It doesn't get in the way. They work down there and they keep stuff in here.
Deirdre, you're going to have to make sure you don't just throw everything in here.
I th- think we have. I'm not sure there's any more room in
that's
here.
That's it. I haven't seen it this full. So they've taken everything from shed one to shed two here today.
It must have been a big Friday afternoon. I don't know.
And I can see trailers and old bits of hay and fertilizer and...
The whole thing. There's the tractor.
Yes, beautiful tractor. Would you be tempted to move here full time?
I didn't think I'd ever come here when we started this project. I wanted a walkway through the forest that was elevated so I wouldn't get snakes on me. So I've come a long way.
Do you have that walkway yet?
No, huh? No.
Deirdre, thank you so much for showing me around your sheds.
Well, thank you so much for taking an interest in them.
Thank you, Jan.
Jan Ryan there with the architect John Choi and the client Deirdre Plummer. And you can see some images of these sheds and they're really worth having a look. You can find them on By Design's Facebook page and on our website too, abc.net.au/rn, and find your way through to the By Design page. And that's the show. Jan Ryan is our producer. Thanks to our sound engineer, Joe Wallace, and my name is Fenella Kernebone. And do stay with us on RN because up next is First Bite with Michael McKenzie.